polarity of computer power supplies, the negative 5-volt lead is grounded to the case, and the positive 5-volt lead is the one that's available to you, and it's no longer floating. And now, if you remove the grounding pin from the 110-volt circuit, and if it is transformer isolated, there's the catch. I think the majority of computer supplies, let me drop. I think the majority of computer-type power supplies these days does not have a power transformer with an isolated primary winding. They tend to take the 60-cycle voltage, the 120 volts, which is really 167 volts peak, simply peak-rectify that into a capacitor, and then use switching regulators to bring it back down. And everything has a common ground on that. And even if you remove the so-called grounding pin, the third pin of the wall outlet, that doesn't make you home free. That thing still is developing 167 volts internally with ground rail reference to the power supply of your house, if you know what I mean. But that first filter capacitor is running off of that that grounded system, and you can't float it without using an isolation transformer. So if your power supply doesn't have a built-in isolation transformer, I believe you cannot do that, Jim. That's my first response on that. It's not the full answer, but you can tell that I'm a little worried on this one. VE3ZTZ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
I'm sorry, you said Jim, but I know you meant Scott. VE3ZTZ running. Yeah, your description is close. I'm not sure if this will help, but you're right. It takes the line voltage, rectifies it, and then passes it in to switch mode circuit where there is another transformer that actually steps it up by, I think, about 300 kilohertz, and the voltages available to the PC are behind that second transformer. And I think that's the part that floats when you take the case ground off. But that's also the part I'm not clear about, which is why I'm asking. So there are two sets of transformers in there. One is the line, something to do with the line and the rectification. And then there's the switch mode high-frequency transformer that the regulated voltages are behind or derived from. So I'm not sure if that helps you help answer my question. VE3ZTZ.
You said some magic words there. If the 300 kilohertz or 1 megahertz toroidal transformer really is not a, what's the word for it now, a three-lead transformer, if it really has a completely separate primary running at 300 kilohertz and a completely separate secondary, then it has all the raw ingredients to be a floating power supply. It has the raw ingredients transformer-wise. So finding out the schematic of the transformer, if it has a thoroughly independent primary and secondary, you're halfway home free. But now there's another catch, and that is the way the printed circuit board is wired, the way it does its referencing of output back to the switching regulator, where it's doing either pulse width modulation or pulse frequency modulation, sometimes that has a common ground on the printed circuit board of the personal computer power supply. So we got to dig a little bit deeper into the wiring. So if you got a high-frequency transformer, you're halfway there, but now how does it do its referencing for the feedback, and is there a common ground on that power supply, and can that be rewired, cut lands in just the right spot so that you end up with a thoroughly floating pulse-width modulated switching network for that 5-volt potential? I think the chances are good, but I think in some cases you're going to have to dig pretty deep to find out how the thing was wired and whether or not it's got a common ground on that printed circuit board. You see where I'm going on that one, Jim. Scott. VE3ZTZ, K2LIW, you got it, Scott.
Net tonight at 8.
Thanks very much. Right. We have the same concerns, I'll just have to play with it and see. No magic bullet here tonight. But I appreciate the information, I appreciate the caution, and it's a winter it for me to try and put one of these three together per couple of the instructions on the internet. Again, I encourage people to look at PC power supplies, reduce, reuse, recycle where possible. They're great. The modern ones are quiet. They don't put any noise into the radio. And if they do, a simple common mode choke, not more capacitors, but magnetics, common mode choke on the DC line, more than clean any little buzz from the switching power supply that might be leaking. Thanks for the information. That's my question for tonight. VE3ZTZ.
WS2N. Poll recognized. Scott, you're onto something really good here, and you've set us thinking again. Because those power supplies in computers that are being thrown out are so prevalent and so inexpensive, and they get so many voltages at so many currents, the 5-volt supply in particular, if it can be made floating, and you take three of these power supplies, and therefore you end up with a whole lot of current at 15 volts, as long as you can make at least two of them float, that's a very worthwhile project. Once you solve this problem, and I think you're going to, it's definitely worth an article, a technical article in any of the good magazines. And let me go one step further. Just in case somebody on frequency has really done this, that is to say they've taken the high current output 5-volt supply, for instance, of multiple computer power supplies, rewired them in some way if needed so that they could put at least two of them in series, acting as a floating 5-volt source, therefore to get a total of 15 volts at high amperes. If anyone knows of anyone in the tri-state area who has done that, please give me your call letters and name right now. K2LAW on the TechNet. Looks like the answer is no one has done it yet. And you may have set us on another beautiful path here, Scott, and I thank you. Ray was the next person who signed in. The next guy on our list is N2LDY, and I'm about to go to him. But Ray, if you are asking for a fill on the subjects we have already covered, and you're not asking a brand new subject, then go right ahead, Ray. And then I'm going to go to Paul right after that. KC2, Mike Yankee. If it's a fill on the current subjects, go right ahead, Ray. K2LIW on the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Yeah, okay, Jake. On the power supply, I mean, I've used them for a few different things. And from what I could tell and what I read, the 12-volt line is not regulated. The 5-volt lines are regulated, especially on the 5+. So I just want to verify with the guy from Canada, how does he know and is he sure that the 12-volt line is regulated? Because I've used that and measured it, and the voltage goes all over the place. It doesn't regulate. It could be that it's a different model that he's using, but I think I was using an ATX also, where you only have to short two pins together to actually turn the power supply on, and then you have all those voltages available. Also high current, very useful power supplies, but my concern was they're not regulated at 12 volts, so can you verify that? Thank you.
And bear in mind now that Scott was telling us he was using the high current output 5-volt output, which he said is regulated. And it has to be regulated because you don't want overvoltage on the 5-volt circuit. Some computers have got a zillion integrated circuit chips running on the 5 volts. So Ray from Yonkers is fairly sure that on many of the supplies, the 12 volts is not very well regulated. You might have an opinion on that one, Scott. I'm going to pass it back to you. VE3ZTZ. K2LIW on the TechNet.
VE3ZTZ returning, Scott in Toronto. From what I know, mine is regulated, and it is a version 2.2 ATX V2.2 power supply. And my understanding is from the tipping point was about 2007, Pentium 4s before and after. That was the tip between the primary, the most of the amperage being on the 5-volt rail to the bulk of the amperage being on the 12-volt rail. Modern PC motherboards have a DC to DC switching power supplies on them for the CPUs and the high-powered video cards. and they draw off the 12 volts draw more heavily than they used to draw on the 5 volts draw. Two things, though. One is some of the 2.x generation ATX power supplies, V2.x, 2.0 to 2.2, I guess, you have to put some of load on the 5-volt rail to get 5-volt and 12-volt regulation. So if the 5-volt rail isn't loaded with either a resistor, 5-watt resistor shorted across, some of the online documentation suggests just taking a automobile tail lamp bulb, 5-watt tail lamp bulb, and putting across the 5-volt rail and just using it as a glow plug kind of thing. But in some of the older ETXs, 2.0 through 2.2, I think, if the 5-volt rail does not have load, you do not have a regulated 12-volt rail. Once the 5-volt rail is loaded, you do have a 12, you do have regulated 12. On my V2.3 power supply, my 12-volt rail is regulated without 5-volt load. V3ZTZ back to net.
Very good, Justin.
Very good, Scott. A lot of valuable information there. Eric recognized. So I think that answers one of your questions, Ray. I know that Paul had a question, had a comment to be made also. Let me go to Eric first, because maybe he's got something to do with the computer. I mean, our network right now, the repeater. KE2EJ, K2REW. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, just a response to the previous statement. The actual switching supply, you know, it's a toroid switching supply. On the earlier models, some of the ATX supplies, the ones that don't provide 3.3 volts to the CPU, the actual regulator circuit really is controlling the pulse with the duty cycle of the switcher itself. So all the supplies are being derived from that one toroid. And the thing that they're most concerned about in the old days is the 5-volt supply. A lot of the newer ones with the multiple voltage supplies actually have individual regulators on the output. They have the rectifiers on the output of the toroid going into individual regulators, one for 5, one for 12, one for 3.3. So, you know, the Chinese technology, they try to cut corners all the time. That's why some of the cheaper older ones just... you didn't load down the 5-volt supply. You didn't have any regulation going at all. K2RW, K2J.
Very good, Eric. More good information. Eric, from what your familiarity is with those individual regulated type of computer power supplies, what do you believe is the degree of difficulty of using the hopefully independent windings on the switching toroid? Is there easy or hard to isolate the individual power supplies and float them so that if I took two or three separate computer power supplies, I could take any of those individual voltages and float them and put them in series. Do you believe that is difficult or not very difficult for a person who is smart enough studying that schematic diagram? KE2EJ, K2RIW on the TechNet.
K2RIW, KE2J. I fixed too many of these power supplies and they're all basically a pain in the butt. The way they're constructed, the way some of them put their regulator boards and switching boards together, as you know, the input side, this all well isolated because it's at line voltage. You know, you don't want to hook a scope up to that side of it. On the other side, they have a tendency to use common ground, so it can be problematic. If you're wise enough and you just want to take the rectifier outputs and float them and then regulate whatever voltage you're looking to make, then you've got something going. You can do that. But the way the supplies are constructed, it's not a lot of fun.
Okay, I'm going to put some words in your mouth. I think you're saying the raw ingredients to do floating power supplies of individual computer power supplies and put them in series, the raw ingredients to do it is almost there, but I think you're saying by the way they come from the factory, lots of modifications are going to be required. You better really have a good copy of the schematic and know what you're doing. Otherwise, it could become problematic. That's what I think you're saying, Eric. And I think you're also saying that some of these are so cheaply made that making these modifications in some cases may not be very easy. KE2EJ for update on that. K2RIW and the tech man.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. Yeah, it depends upon the manufacturer. Yes, you can do it. You can do it to all of them. It just depends upon how much gusto you want to put into doing it. You can simply go right after the usually use full wave rectifiers. Some of the supplies use half wave rectifiers. You would just, you know, the way the boards are laid out, you can cut the lens, isolate the rectifying and filtering part before it gets to the regulating part, lift that out and gang it together with another supply, and you've got it. But the way they cram the boards into the little box, it makes it not a lot of fun, but it's a doable thing.
Okay, my interpretation of that is if you're really enthusiastic and you know what you're doing and you've got a good schematic diagram that you've either derived or you've gotten from the manufacturer.
You don't need the schematic if you understand power supplies.
Yeah, let me ask you that one, Eric. How many of these popular power supplies for personal computers can I easily get a schematic for? Is that schematic held close to the chest of the manufacturer, or is that universally available on the internet or someplace like that? KE2EJ, K2RAW.
I'll be very honest with you. In most cases, it's like pulling teeth. It's very rare that I've ever actually come up with a real schematic for any of these things.
I was really afraid that was going to be the answer. The reason I asked that question also is because a particular company I know of threw out a whole lot of individual power supplies, something of the vicinity, as I remember, of 12 volts at 9 amperes. A whole lot of them were thrown out. And as such, to regulate, to readjust the regulation from 12.0 up to, let me pick a number, 13.9, would be pretty easy once you knew enough about the schematic. To get the schematic of these things was very, very difficult. And in some cases, these modern-day power supplies, to take this tightly packed printed circuit board and for you to re-derive your own schematic, you're going to spend a couple of hours doing it under a bright light with a magnifying glass, and it's not easy. And you can be fooled with multi-layered boards. So
you can take it easy on that, because the power supplies that they use, they tend to use big lens. They tend not to use multi-layered boards in the supplies because it's just too much current.
Okay, so what Eric is telling us then, if you're sufficiently enthusiastic, because the manufacturer is not, 90% of the time I'm hearing, is not going to give you the schematic, and you know you can't get the schematic, you're going to have to derive your own. But because it's a big layout, inexpensively made, single layer board, maybe deriving the schematic for a smart guy is not too difficult.
Double-sided, sir, don't get me wrong.
Say that again, Eric, because I talked on top of you.
The boards are double-sided. They're not multi-layer, that's all.
Okay, so therefore you can, in theory, see both sides of the board with your eyes and your bright light and your magnifying glass or end of a microscope. You can see both sides of the board and you can trace out the schematic. And printed circuit boards for power supplies are made so inexpensively, they are not 3, 4, 5-layer boards. You take, for instance, a printed circuit board on a modern-day cell phone, in many cases, 14-layer board with various coupling holes in between the wiring of the individual layers. You take a modern-day cell phone, and if you think you're going to trace out the schematic diagram of that 14-layer board, I don't think you're going to live long enough. You might have an opinion on that one, Eric. K2EJ, K2LAW.
So that brings up a good story. I had a broadcast camera that was discontinued. They didn't make the boards. And the boards had actually one of the lens internally burned up. I gave it to my friend who was a radiologist. I had him x-ray the damn thing with the hope and praying that the chips wouldn't fly when he did it.
Wow. Now, because of the very small layout of the individual wires and components on a modern-day integrated circuit for that camera, are you telling me that his x-ray machine had enough resolution on that multi-layer board that you could figure out what was happening? And how successful was that project? Did that work, Eric? K2EJ, K2RIW?
K2RIW, H2RIWK2J. Well, let me tell you this much. When you go to the dentist now, they don't use film. They use CCD-type sensors. And they're actually very, very sensitive, so you hit them with very, very small doses of X-ray. And we were lucky. Resolution was great enough because this was the plate that they used for chest X-ray. It had really good resolution. And I'll send you a file so you can see what it looks like. It's really funny. I mean, it took days to trace it out, but we eventually fixed it.
Z-T-Z, this comment.
Z-T-Z recognized, but you're going to be after a pull. Hey, as long as we're at it with these great medical instrumentation, Eric, can you imagine if we could get a three-dimensional MRI of our printed circuit boards? I know it's probably out of the question because the MRI is really looking for, I think it's hydrogen atoms, and you don't have a liberal sprinkling of hydrogen atoms in a printed circuit board. But can you imagine if you...
1,000 watts that's going around.
Yeah, you've got a huge magnetic field. So I think an MRI of a printed circuit board is out of the question. But a dental X-ray, you're saying, can be done. Is that true, Eric?
Yeah, not only dental X-rays, but full-size plates for femurs and that kind of thing. They have them now. Still, a lot of hospitals still use film because the sensors that they use are kind of expensive. But then again, it's medical. I mean, how much does an MRI machine cost? How many millions?
Okay, we ham radio operators have to develop some good friendships with dentists and other X-ray technicians. They've got the stuff that we need. For us to own our own X-ray machine, I think it's out of the question. Paul, I know you wanted to ask a question, then I'm going to go over to Scott in that order. Paul, WS2N, go right ahead. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hey, yeah, to go back to the charging unit. Instead of hope brewing something like this, I mean, that's okay if you have a generator and you can charge all your devices with that. But most of us didn't have a generator. You know, most people actually don't have it. What I used was these power packs, like, for instance, Die Hard makes them, these portable power packs. You've seen them with a big clamp on the end, and you can jump your car, if your car is in bad shape, your battery failed, you hook this on and you could jump your car. These things are multi-purpose units. You have an outlet for a cigarette lighter. You have that kind of an outlet, and with that you can get anything. Because what I do is I went to Radio Shack and I bought NSL has a good different adapters. One was an inverter, 75 watt inverter, and another one I bought was for the USB. You plug it in, you get a couple of USB ports coming out of it. Let me drop it. You know, without power for 7 days, I can't tell you how many times I recharge my cell phones. I recharge my 2 meter ham radio. Talk to the Linemark StormNet over and over again, and my tablet. That's the other thing. The tablet was USB, able to plug that thing in. I was able to communicate with that when the cell phones were down, so that was very valuable. And if you recharge that tablet on a PC, they say it takes, I don't know, 12, 13 hours or something, but if you recharge it on this battery pack with particular type of USB cigarette adapter thing that I plugged in, no problem, a half hour, less than that whole thing is 100% charged from zero. So that got me through 7 days, and I don't know how many amp hours I had left in it, but I had another one as a backup if I needed it, but I never went near the second one. Back to you, Dick.
Fantastic. Hey, Paul, I've got a series of two or three questions here, though. These power packs that you bought, apparently you own two of them. Did you buy them just before Superstorm Sandy and you knew what was coming? Or did you buy them after Superstorm Sandy because nobody knew what they were, and therefore there wasn't an
out of stock of those things. That's question number one. Question number two, it's got a finite 12-volt gel cell battery in pack, I believe most of them. Were you recharging that from your automobile car, and you're running your ham radio equipment with that? Is that how I understand what was going on here? In other words, you would periodically bring it over to your automobile, run it, charge it, then bring it back into the house and use that to run your ham radio equipment. That's what I think you're saying you were doing. So when did you buy them? How much did you pay? And how were you using it? So, WS2M, K2LIW. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, I've had the one, it's got to be 18 years when they first came out. At least, that thing came out of Kmart. And that was only around 40. And now they have the Die Hard by Sears. I like that one. The 750, I think that's 59. You can get them on sale for less, though. I didn't need to recharge it. I could have done that. If they really failed, but I never needed to recharge this thing. And it kept on going. So 7 days of recharging cell phones, and I use that a lot, cell phones. The tablet I use quite a bit. And then, of course, the biggest draw is the HT, but I didn't talk that long. I gave a report here and there and mostly listened, And then it's got a light on there if I want to, I left it on the kitchen table. So I probably had that thing 17, 18 years, and I was using the older one. And I believe that had a 17 amp hour charge. I forgot what the new Sears one has. But you get a lot. Well, you figure it out, 17 amp hours. I mean, how many amps are you going to pour into all these electronic devices? I know I didn't get near probably halfway. Over 7 days, Dick. Back to you.
Wow. 17 ampere hours of the battery. I'm guessing it was a lead acid battery, maybe a sealed lead acid battery or a gel cell. 17 years later, and you still were getting full capacity out of that battery. You hadn't replaced that battery. You hadn't done the desulfating process with a battery minder. You're telling me you had on the shelf 17 years of storage of that battery pack, that power pack, with its battery, and you didn't have to replace it. I'm amazed that you weren't a little worried about the aging of that battery, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW.
Well, I recharge them every 2 months, religiously. That's the thing. If you own these things, you have to be that type of person. You can't just leave it in your garage and forget about it. And I was carrying them in a car. And, this one was getting older, so I bought this Die Hard maybe, 3-4 years ago. And carry that around in the car. And the older one I kind of leave in the house and play around with it, plug stuff in now and then. That's my, every time the power fails, I'll plug something into that. And, to give you an idea, you could take like my inverter, my 75 watt inverter, I could plug that in and plug it like a 35 watt lamp, and it, it'll light up just like normal. I should leave it on and see how long it would last, but I haven't done that. Not worried about it. The LED lights let you know whether or not it's fully charged. That failed maybe 10-15 years ago. About 10 years ago. Probably had 18 years, so after about 8 years, that LED setup failed, and you really never know when it's a full charge on it. So if I have any doubt, I just plug it in for 24 hours, and then unplug it. I mean, it still works, because, once in a while, I'll jump a car, that needs to be jumped, and it still works. How many cranking amps do you get out of something like that? 600 cranking amps or something for 30 seconds. I mean, it's a powerful thing, Dick.
I have the impression you carry the power pack in your car just to make sure you've got standby battery for starting the automobile in case its battery should give you grief. Maybe you run other pieces of electronics with it. My real question, though, Paul, is in your house in Ronkonkoma, you were without power during this event for how many days? How many days were you without telephone, internet, television, cable TV. So for how many days were you without power, and were you living on this battery pack during that time? WS2N, K2LAW.
Yeah, this battery pack did it all. And like I had the other one if I needed it, but I didn't. Almost seven, well, just over 6 days. So I went into the seventh day. And then another 6 days of no TV. Well, actually, I had TV. That's a lie. I had the no cable TV. I had over-the-air broadcast TV. Two different rooms. I have to hook up to one antenna. In fact, that's the way to go. You really need broadcast. You need those boxes. Because without that, I would have went nuts the last 6 days. No cable for computer and no telephone. That's bad. And, if you're in an emergency situation, you definitely need cell phones, at least. And they weren't working in the beginning. But at least when they came back to life, I had this thing to, I never worried about losing a charge on this thing. I just plug it in at night like regular stick. So with the inverter and with this, let me comment about the HT. One second, let me drop it. V8, when you buy the V8 ICOM, they don't give you, you can't buy any kind of an adapter to plug into your cigarette lighter in the car. That's one bad thing with that. But what I do, if I want to plug it into the car, or I usually use the battery packs, I'll take the inverter, the 75-watt inverter, plug it into the battery pack, and then I'll take my charger, which normally plugs into the wall. I'll take that, which is hooked up to the ICOM 2-meter HT. I just plug that into the inverter, and off I go, Dick. So that's how I get around that.
One last question here, though, Paul. I think you were out of telephone and internet and television, cable TV for like 14 days. You told me, I think, that your power was out of your house for roughly 1 week. Are you telling me that you had no generator for that 1 week? You had only these battery packs, these power packs. How did you heat your house? How did you heat your hot water? How did you keep your refrigerator running? I am getting the impression that maybe you camped out and lived in the cold, wore the ski jacket. By way of the battery pack, you periodically had radio and lights, but where did the heat and refrigeration come from for that week that you were without power, Paul? Boy, you must be rugged. WS2N, K2LAW.
No, I'm not rugged. I spent a couple of days with my daughters, but it got cold. No, those couple of days I bailed out, but no way to heat the house, unfortunately. That was bad. Refrigerator, everything went bad in that. That went into the garbage. And that's pretty much it. Walked around with a lot of coats on. But until it got really cold. And I took my power pack with me. And you know what? I could have charged it over there, but it didn't need it. I just left the thing in the car. But yeah, I always drive around with that. You never know if your battery's going to fail. Or just not too long ago, a month or so ago, some young fella got stuck at one of the stores, and we were leaving, and he asked for a jump. I said, no, I don't have a jump, but I have one of these. And he looked at it, he thought it looked like a toy, a bunch of clamps on it. I said, it'll work. It always works. Unless there's something wrong with your car. Jumped it, and he says, I gotta get one of them. I go to that store, or bring me a Kmart. I think they're for 50 bucks, you go buy one. Back to you, Dick, WS2N.
Of all the discussions that John and I have had for the last month on various kinds of ways of powering cell phones and houses and oil burners and everything else, you've got an entirely different technique here we never even considered, these power packs. And I own one of them, It's sitting on the shelf in the basement, and mine has a cigarette lighter plug on it. Wow. What I didn't consider. As a result, one last question, Paul. I keep saying that. As a result of this event, are you tempted to buy a generator for your backyard? Or are you fairly sure you don't need it and it's not worth it? WS2N, K2LIW?
YZX. No, I'd say 10, 20 years ago, I would have continued on. No, a generator is on the way. It's got to be there. No, that's going to happen. The one I had, the old one I liked better, you know, it had two plugs, two cigarette plugs, individual switches, plus a light on it. The Diehard has one outlet, plus a light on it. So, I mean, if you want dual capability at the same time, with the Sears one, then I should go out and get, you know, those a Y connection. You know, you plug a male connection and then you get two of them sticking out. I should pick up one of those at Radio Shack. NSL, by the way, NSL is a good company for all these adapting things. I really like them from Radio Shack. But yeah, I definitely got to get a generator before the next storm. I was going to do it this time, but maybe a year ago, but I put it off, unfortunately. Back to you there.
RGX recognized. You got one guy ahead of you, Scott. I know you want to make some further comments here, Scott. VE3, do you have more of these breakthroughs you're going to bring to our attention though, Scott? VE3, ZTZ in Toronto, K2RIW in the TechNet. Go ahead, Scott.
In Toronto, VE3ZTZ returning. Well, I don't know. I can open the toolbox and reach in and see what comes out. My comment goes back to the how do you figure out what the circuit is for the power supply. The way I did it, for what it's worth, is you take your bright, shiny flashlight and you go in and you find the integrated circuit that is the switch mode regulator. Take the part number off of that and go find its data sheet on the Internet. They are all out there, and almost every data sheet worth anything has a reference circuit in it, and the reference circuit is surprisingly close to the production circuit, and that's how I found where the voltage divider resistors and which pin, and then traced back from that pin, found the two resistors that constituted the voltage divider to take it up from 12.4 to 13.4. It was just a surprise I could get it. I couldn't quite get it to 13.8. But that's how I helped myself with the power supply circuit, is I looked up the regulator IC, found its data sheet, and then used its reference circuit as the template for the real PC board that was sitting in front of me, and used the two to come up with the answer. V3ZTZ, back to net.
Thank you, Scott. Scott, more good information. Sometimes when it comes to a simple two-sided printed circuit board, if you've got a bright enough light behind it, and you can shine the light through the board, sometimes that makes life a little bit easier when it comes to tracing out the schematic. Mr. RGX, I didn't get your prefix, sir, so give me the full call and your name, and then right ahead with your question or comment, as long as it's on the subject so far, not a brand new subject. Mr. RGX, K2LAW, go ahead.
Hey, Stick, it's K2IVX, Len. Just a question for, I'll never forget what's his name. I did exactly the same thing with a power pack that I had for 17, 18 years to charge cell phones and run some lights, a fluorescent camping type light. But I've been notably unsuccessful in correlating the peak cranking amperes to an ampere hour rating. I wonder, Dick, if you have discussed that this evening, I came in late, or whether the other fellow, Pete, I forget his name, I apologize, talked about that at all. Ned, go ahead. This is K2 India Victor X-ray.
Yes, Harry, I didn't hear you call it as correctly there, Lynn. And so, more guys in Mount Washington. I think you're asking if you know the cold cranking amperes, but what you really want to know is ampere hours. Your car battery has some number of ampere hour rating. batteries might be in the vicinity of 35 ampere hours. In other words, in theory, it can dish out 35 amps for a solid hour, or it can dish out 1 amp for 35 hours. 35 ampere hours at 12 volts. And you multiply that amp times 12 volts, you know how many watt hours the battery is good for. And if you knew the efficiency of your inverter that's converting that 12 volts into 120 volts, for instance, then you know how many watts you can get for how long. And you got to worry a little bit about the fact that a lead-acid battery, it may be good for 35 ampere hours, but there's a catch. You really drain out all 35 ampere hours. To some degree, you're doing damage. However, we're discovering by way of what the guys in Toronto have been telling us, there's this thing called Battery Minder, and there's a couple of other brand names, which will take a self-faded lead-acid battery that has been deeply discharged and damaged and remove essentially all of the damage when it comes to restoring the battery at a later time. So I may not have answered the question you asked, so give it to me again now, Len. K2 India Victor X-ray, K2 LIW in the TechNet.
Fine, Dick. Well, I understand that calculation pretty well, but I've had some experience with different kinds of batteries, and as you know, a nickel cadmium or maybe even a lithium ion at this point have a tendency to hold a voltage that they and then drop off a cliff. At least the nickel cad used to do that. So the chemistry of the battery has something to do with its ability to deliver ampere hours versus its ability to deliver cranking amps, and I'm sure it must be related to the internal impedance. In other words, a lead acid battery, or with a given ampere hour rating, is going to act differently than another battery in a cranking application. If you know what I mean, Dick. Over.
Yeah, we've all run into the problem where on a winter day, a five-year-old battery in our automobile will no longer start the engine. And that battery has been thoroughly degraded. In some cases, it's because somebody left the headlights on for 4 hours and drained it too deeply and damaged it. And it never comes back to the normal ampere hours if you do normal charging. What I'm hearing, 80 or 90% of the time, what you think is a out-of-service battery, a so-called dead battery, where it's got very few ampere hours left when fully charged, that a high percentage of those batteries on this battery minder thing, where it literally charges the battery with a very strong AC signal superimposed on the DC, which blasts away from the plates all the bad chemistry that created the sulfating, and it desulfates the battery, in many cases brings it back to life. So even though your car battery might be 5 years old, with this restoration process with that fancy charger, may be able to, in many cases, bring it back to 95% of the capacity it had when it was brand new. So that's part of what we've been hearing over the last couple of weeks, Lynn. So you're worried about the fact that an older battery, partially discharged, might not have anywhere near the ampere hours you think. And when you're running an inverter, it is nowhere near, in 99% of the time, it's nowhere near, let me drop, nowhere near the really heavy service that your starter motor creates. A good starter motor on an automobile locked rotor when you're first starting on a cold day probably is drawing 200 amperes. And now the question is, what voltage does the battery drop down to? Does it really have 200 or 300 cranking amperes for that super cold day? That's the severe environment for a battery. But when you and I are using the battery as a source of energy to run inverters and battery packs and things like that, we're never drawing 200 amperes. So that mode of battery operation doesn't come into play. What you and I care about now is how many ampere hours are left and whether or not it has been properly treated with this battery minder. Maybe you've been already hearing these battery minder stories, and the guys in Toronto have been using them for years, and they think it's the best thing since baked bread. And many of us down here are hearing this information for the first time. So maybe you're already in on some of those earlier conversations. And if not, you can go back to some of the past TechNets by listening on amateurradio.tangovictor. Back to you, Len. K2 India Victor X-ray, K2 LIW in the TechNet.
Apologize. I'm not asking the question right. I'm not concerned about worn-out batteries. Let's take brand-new batteries. And I'm saying that a nickel-cad maybe a lead acid, maybe a lithium ion with the same ampere hour rating for a low or relatively low load will not act the same way in a cranking mode trying to start the motor. So as this fellow was talking about, I've been looking at that 750 ampere cranking power pack, and then there's another one for 900. But I've been unsuccessful in finding out what those two numbers mean to me in terms of ampere hours. They just don't give that number, because in a starting application it doesn't mean anything. But I do know batteries will act differently. Well, I don't want to, I'm repeating myself. Anyway, thank you for the input, Dick. I did hear the conversation about the rejuvenation. I think it was a week or two ago. I listen, I don't always jump in. But in this particular case, I'm talking about equal-age batteries, brand-new batteries. Thanks an awful lot for taking the question, Dick. Have a good night. Happy holidays to everybody. K2IVX. Go ahead, Dick.
Dick WS, do you want to comment on that?
VGP with a comment.
Yeah, I was definitely going to go back to Paul. Something's wrong here. First of all, lead acid, nickel metal hydride, nickel cadmium, many of these batteries, when you plot voltage versus time as you're just charging it, the curve is relatively flat, and all of a sudden, when you come near the end of charge, it falls off like a cliff. Many batteries have that factor. Now, this battery pack that Paul has been telling us about that he likes so much, where he clips onto a battery with these great big clamps. If Paul told me that his battery, his power pack with those clamps, was capable of dishing out, let me pick a number, 150 amperes to run a starter motor, I'd believe it. If you're telling me, Len, that some brand name of portable battery pack can dish out 750 or 900 amperes with simple clips that you clip onto the probes of the battery in the car, I'm very skeptical. You can't, with a simple clip-on device, you can't deliver that kind of current. It is a huge, wide braid with a great big clamp, with a 3/8 inch bolt that you tighten down to the lug of the battery, and you want to get 700 amperes out of there. Maybe. So something's wrong with those numbers. Maybe Paul can clear that up for us. WS2N, K2RIW, go ahead, Paul.
When these things first came out, those numbers, yeah, they stood for amps. Like the first one I had, the old one is 600. And then the Die Hard by Sears is the 750. They're talking about taking that 600 number. That would be 600 amps for 30 seconds in an ideal situation. Probably, like you said, you'd have to have a U-clamp bolted around the battery or whatever. But that's what they say the capability is. Of course, that's not going to happen. You're going to clamp it on, and first of all, your starter motor will probably draw maybe a couple hundred amps at most. So that means you could probably crank this thing maybe two or three minutes before it ever dies. I mean, I've gone a long time because I've done people's cars where it had real problems, and it seems like it lasts forever. I mean, you sit there crank, and maybe after about two or three minutes, it starts to die on you, and then it's over. That means there's something seriously wrong with that guy's car. It ain't going to start there. But I think that's where they got the numbers. They call them 600 cold cranking amps for 30 seconds. I believe it was freezing or 32 degrees. No, but I think it was 32 degrees back in there.
I'm a bit worried here, Paul, that this is specmanship, Paul and Len. I think specmanship's going on here. Paul, describe to me, is that 2-gauge wire coming out of this battery pack? And how big is that clamp that clamps onto the lugs of the car battery? I think it would take 2-gauge wire with a god-awful clamp that you and I wouldn't be able to... It would take Arnold Schwarzenegger to open the spring on that clamp in order to get a tight enough contact with enough micro-ohms on that battery terminal to dish out 700 or 900 amperes. Something's wrong with those numbers. How big was that clamp? How much muscle power was required to open it, Paul? And how heavy was the gauge of that wire?
KW-S2N, K2LIW.
Heavy, oh god, it's gotta be, I'm gonna say 3/8 of an inch in diameter. It's gotta be the wire. So yeah, it's just like a set of jumper cables, and the clamps itself, that you squeeze, I've got a real good set of jumper cables. And you've got to squeeze a lot harder on these than you do on them, Dick. They are heavy duty.
Okay, you and Len are starting to say the right words. I'm beginning to become a believer. Wow. And the one I've got is nowhere near as beefy as the ones you guys are using. Hey, John, clear this up for us. How many battery packs, how many power packs do you own, and how many amperes of cold cranking do you think they're good for, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW in the tech net.
G2SYL comment.
SYL, stand by, we'll get to you. Go ahead, John.
KC2WGB, 11 liter traffic. I think my comment is on Scott's question with these power supplies. Now, in my lab, when I've had this power supply requirement, the stack power supplies, what I did was basically at the toroid, I would get the rectification done, use the existing filter network, cut the LANs off, and put a DC to DC converter from 5 to 5 volts. They make them. They're not expensive. The ones I used were 10 amps each, and I was able to stack 4 power supplies. And that gives you the isolation, plus those DC to DC converters have their own regulated circuit in it. And it works extremely well. Done it many times.
Okay, good information. And thank you. Let's see what Williams has to say here. KC2SYL, go right ahead with your comments, sir. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Good evening to the net. My name is Bill, Northeastern Queens. I just looked up, I did a search on cold cranking amps and amp hours, and eham.net has a forum subject on it. Basically, the cranking, cold cranking amps, according to this comment by KE4SKY, who is a member of EHAM, indicates that it'll provide, this is the power pack I'm referring to now, will provide high amperage for several seconds. Group 27, I'm going to read this if I may. Group 27 battery rated at 100 amp hours will maintain the 5 amp load continuously for 20 hours. But if you're doing it as, you know, cold cranking as you're talking about, it'll be for a very short period of time. And I'll read the other comment here. The standard BCI, CCI rating is at 0 degrees and so on. It talks about marine cranking amps at 32 degrees. Engine starting batteries designed to provide a heavy surge current for as much as 200 amps for a period of 5 to 10 seconds. There is no direct correlation between CCA, which would be cold cranking amps, and amp hours, because starting batteries are not designed for slow periods of deep discharge. And that's for, eham.net, one of the forums. Back to net.
Bill, I'm beginning to think you gave the answer that Len is asking for. So according to that particular net and those particular specs on those units, Len, it appears as though there's no direct correlation between ampere hours of normal discharge versus those zillions of amperes of cold cranking for some small number of seconds. Looks like there's no correlation. I'm getting to think that if the manufacturer didn't tell you separately how many ampere hours the battery is good for at normal current drain, if he didn't give that to you, then you might not know. See if Len has any further questions on this one. K2 India Vector X-ray, K2RIW, go ahead, Len.
WS2N.
Len first, go ahead, Len. We're still getting some information for Len, and he may have left us already. Go ahead, Paul, WS2N, K2RIW.
Okay, yeah, the manufacturer on the first one, Power Boost, I think is the name of it, but it is some off-brand, but they did give the information that it's 17 amp hours, so I'll have to look up, look the paperwork up for the diehard, see what they say. But yeah, you know, I didn't pull that number out of the sky, though.
Okay, so I'm going to say that the more reputable manufacturers are giving you cold cranking amperes for one number and ampere hours the other number, and now you get both numbers because in some cases they are not related to each other. You'd like to believe that bigger ampere hours would be a bigger number of cranking amperes, and not necessarily. One is determining how many milliamperes, how many milliohms of internal resistance the battery has, and the other is telling you how much area there is to the plate and how much volume there is to the sulfuric acid. So what is the total capacity in joules? That's what we're really asking here. The relations of the total number of joules of watt seconds of or kilowatt hours, so to speak, of the battery at one rating and when fully charged for a very brief period of time, how many cold cranking amperes it can give you is another entirely different rating, a function of design. You can take one and not the other in the way you design that battery, is the impression I'm getting. Okay. John, let's go over to the mailbag. I know it's too darn late, but what the heck. Maybe some of these guys will go to the mailbag by way of the amateurradio.tv Tango Victor website. Therefore, even though they can't stay up this late, they can still get the information. So choose a couple of those nice questions you've been getting, the juicy questions, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB, good evening to everyone on the net. Okay, I have a question. If you remember, Dick, back in the dark ages, when we worked on things, we dealt with integrators and differentiators, which were discrete components, usually on a terminal strip, resistors, capacitors, things like that. And now they're built into little packages, approximately 2 inches by an inch, by about maybe a quarter of an inch or eighth of an inch thick. And coming out of the bottom, maybe there's 8 leads or so. Now, this gentleman would like to know, what do they do, how do they work, what are they used for, and the difference between the two. And I know we used to use them in, like, in many sync circuits, synchronizing circuits and things like that. If you could just give him a general description about all of those items, if possible, I'm sure he would appreciate that.
I'm going to start off with an integrator. An integrator is an electronic circuit which, if you look at it as a black box and you are sweeping it, it really is an extreme version of a low-pass filter. An integrator will pass very low frequencies and have a lot of attenuation at high frequencies. At first doesn't sound like that's very useful. I'd like to know it all. I'm connecting my oscilloscope and I want to know all the information that's there. Why would I want to restrict it with a low pass filter and throw away the high frequencies? I'm going to answer that question. An awful lot of Mother Nature is really spiky information. Noise is very noisy. Human speech is very spiky. Let's assume now that I'm trying to set up the gain circuit on the microphone of your broadcast transmitter. And for whatever reason, I want the voltage coming out of the microphone plus its amplifier circuit to be around 0 dBm on a 600 ohm line. Yeah, that might be something possible for some broadcasts. Many audio circuits in many environments, 600 ohms is the standard impedance. And the amount of power there, 0 dBm, is roughly 1 milliwatt. You want 1 milliwatt of average power. Okay. You look with your oscilloscope with a very fast responding voltmeter, power meter, whatever. You're going to find something really crazy about human speech. Let me drop. Human speech has a crest factor on average of 23 dB. That means if I had a very slow responding power meter, and you listen to my voice as I speak a couple of sentences, and you take the average power of my speech, it might very well be, with proper gain setting, 1 milliwatt of average power, 0 dBm. 1 milliwatt of average power of my speech might be what you're listening to right now. However, as I say something with a P sound to it, a puff of air comes out of me. That means that during that instant of time,